Good evening. Good evening. Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengrabe. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, known as Live from the New York Public Library. My goal, as all of you know who have come here before, is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when successful, to make it levitate. I am, and I hope tonight will be one of those levitation moments. I'm particularly delighted that Live from the New York Public Library is partnering for the first time with National Geographic, a publication that has been at the forefront of discovery for 125 years, and just 2 weeks ago won 4 national magazine awards, which are the Oscars of the magazine industry. So a big... They were recognized for general excellence as well as multimedia and tablet publications, all illustrating how the National Geographic at 125 is just like the New York Public Library at 105, charging into the digital future. A quick word about next week before we come to tonight. Next Tuesday, I will be speaking to the artist Matthew Barney, and on Wednesday, the chef Dave Chang will be joined by other chefs in an evening entitled Cook It in the Raw. So join us. Tonight is all about risky business. We are honored to be presenting 5 extraordinary risk takers who have worked tirelessly to make the world a better, more knowable place. Lindsay Adario, James Nachtway, Enrico Sala, Zoltan Takac, and Anne Curry. I'm sure that most of you are familiar with National Geographic and its jaw-dropping photography from around the globe, but you may not be aware of the active role National Geographic plays in not only documenting the extremes of human achievement and the new frontiers of technologies that shape our world, but conceptualizing and underwriting such endeavors. Ralph Waldo Emerson stated that nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm, echoing perhaps Machiavelli, who believed that never was anything great achieved without danger, echoing perhaps Virgil, who thought that fortune sides with him who dares. Will Rogers, echoing none of the above, said, "Why not go on a limb? That's where the fruit is." I would like tonight to thank, especially warmly, Melanie Cornwell for bringing this risky project to my attention and entrusting us to produce it with her. I have enjoyed working with Melanie over the last decade. Every project we have done together has been filled with excitement and risk. I also wish to thank Jennifer Berman and her team at the National Geographic. We have wanted to work together for years, Jennifer and I, and tonight is our start. Hopefully, we are going on a limb together towards a fruitful relationship between the National Geographic and Live from the New York Public Library. Tonight, to present 2 of the riskiest risk takers and explorers, please welcome Terry Garcia, head of the National Geographic Mission Group and Explorers Program. Terry.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. As you just heard, we're here to talk about risk. Actually, we're here to talk about exploration, and risk is an essential ingredient of all exploration programs. And you'll read, I hope, soon in the June issue of the magazine, this notion of risk that we've interwoven throughout the issue. And in fact, throughout the year, as Paul mentioned, this is our 125th anniversary. We're celebrating it all year. And the theme of this anniversary is the new age of exploration. And anytime you have an anniversary, it's always an opportunity to sort of reflect back at what you've done, but also to look forward, and in this case, say, what's left to explore. Before I get to that, I wanted to just say a few words about how we got here. I've already said it was 125 years ago, and 33 explorers came together in Washington, D.C. They were several hundred yards from the White House for the purpose of considering the proposition, should they launch a society for the increase and diffusion of geographic knowledge? And there was this very ambitious talk about producing a journal, about funding exploration, about public outreach. It took about 9 months after they decided to form the organization that we published the first issue of the magazine. In fact, its 125th anniversary will be in October of this year. And, you know, before radio, before television, before movies, this magazine really served as a window for armchair explorers. It was the first introduction, in fact, for many people. We added television in the 60s. We added digital media, social media in the 80s, or rather in the 90s, film in the 80s. And in 2001, we launched our National Geographic Channel. And today, National Geographic reaches about 450 million people each month. And we publish in more than 30 languages, in fact, 38 to be exact. So there are millions of people that know National Geographic as either a magazine or as a television channel. So they're often surprised when I say to them that we're not a media company, or at least we're not just a media company. The mission is not to publish a magazine, and the mission is not to produce documentaries. If that familiar yellow border that you see on the magazine has come to define the face of the organization, exploration has always defined our heart. You know, the founder's ambition was to go farther, higher, and deeper than anyone had gone before, and then to tell the story so that everyone could experience it. And that's what we've done. We've sent over a century of adventurous men and women out into the field to map the blank spaces on the maps, the blank spaces in human knowledge. And we've provided resources to explore every corner of the planet. In fact, we view this as venture capital for science. We've provided funding when others were reluctant to do so because either the project was too risky or the individuals involved were untested. As of today, we've funded more than 10,000 expeditions and field research projects around the world. And here's the best... Yeah, good. Now, here's the best part. There are still mysteries out there. There are still discoveries to be made. And there's still opportunities to explore. And in fact, I would submit that the 21st century is going to be the greatest age of exploration in human history. Now, that's partly due to the advent of technology that is giving us the ability to go places we couldn't go before, to see things, to be able to open doors that had seemed to be permanently closed to us. So we've got now the tools to continue to explore. We have explorers who are certainly willing to go out there. And one of the questions that I get often is, well, has the personality of the explorer changed? And I would submit that it hasn't. And I wanted to read something to you. It's from an ad that appeared in a newspaper in London in 1914. And it said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success." How can you resist that, right? Well, that was an ad that Ernest Shackleton took out to recruit men for his proposed Antarctic transect. Now, today, I suppose most people reading this would go, well, what about the benefits? What about the 401k plan? But the people that we're talking about, these explorers, they're not wired like most people. The mountaineer Lew Whitaker had both eyeballs freeze as he climbed Everest. And he said that, you know, the worst part was not having his eyeballs freeze. The worst part was when they started to thaw, that the pain was unbearable. And so if you want the personality of explorers, I'd say that they're all determined, incredibly focused. Many of them are obsessed, if not crazed. All are brave. Some of them are optimistic to the point of self-delusion. They're addicted, and by the way, we love that as an organization because that's what keeps us going. They're addicted, frankly, to the business. They can't walk away. And so why is that? What is it that causes people to want to explore, that keeps them going and pushing the boundaries? And, you know, there have been a lot of recent studies, and for years, doctors and scientists have been searching for the genetic answer. Is there an explorer's gene, you know, a strand of DNA that predisposes us to be restless or more restless than others? But recent studies, and you'll read about it in the magazine this month, appear to indicate that it comes down to neurotransmitters and to dopamine production. Brains that don't produce enough tend to be more apathetic, inclined to take less risk, a lack of motivation. Those that have an excess of it tend to take more risk. At National Geographic, we have a rather healthy supply of dopamine producers. So let's take an example. Kenny Broad, who was supposed to be here tonight as an example. Kenny's an environmental anthropologist. He regularly participates in extreme scientific and filmmaking expeditions, and he recently led, you'll see this image, an expedition to the Bahamas Blue Hole. And discovered inland caves that are the scientific equivalent of Tut's tomb. And from a diver's perspective, these Bahamas Blue Holes are like Everest or K2. It requires a similar amount of training, of specialization, of special equipment, and even more than high altitude climbers. Cave divers work under tremendous time pressure. And only a handful of divers have visited this realm that Kenny visited. And in 2009, Kenny took a team to explore these blue holes and gather data on everything from geology and water chemistry to biology, paleontology, archaeology, astrobiology, all of the ologies. And Kenny's partner in this expedition, I should note, was the famed photographer Wes Skiles, and Wes actually died shortly after the expedition in a diving accident. And Kenny talks about this frequently, and he says that it doesn't stop him, that, you know, people ask him, well, why would you want to go to, and this is Kenny talking, why would you want to go to a crummy, muddy little hole, and why would you want to do something that's perceived as being extremely risky? He gets called to do some things that most of us would reject as preposterous, and yet he does it. And that's why he isn't here tonight. 2 weeks ago, on location in the Bahamas, Kenny suffered a fall. Here he is, and broken arm, some ribs, banged up his face. He's going to be fine. His sense of humor is intact. In fact, he pointed out that this was... Yes, this is the depressed Kenny. You saw the happy Kenny just before that. He pointed out that, well, you know, he wasn't so good looking before the accident, so it really doesn't matter. He's going to be fine. Anyway, he's going to be back, but on doctor's orders, he can't join us tonight. But Dr. Zoltan Takish, however, is with us. He worked with Kenny. In fact, he and Kenny went to Vietnam in 2011 looking for venomous snakes. As part of a study to examine traditional medicine as well as the use of these snakes in illegal wildlife trade. Zoltan is featured in our risk-takers portfolio. He's a scientist and an adventurer and a National Geographic emerging explorer. His official title is venomologist, which means that he helps develop drug leads from the world's most dangerous and venomous animals. He's the co-inventor of the designer toxin technology and toxin genomics platform that he developed while at the University of Chicago. He holds a PhD in pharmacology from Columbia for his study on cobra venom. He's traveled to more than 138 countries doing field work extracting venom and DNA samples from what I can assure you are subjects who did not volunteer to be tested and who tend to be very cranky when they are subjected to these tests. So following Zoltan tonight will be Dr. Enrique Sala. Enrique is an explorer in residence at National Geographic, and he leads a most interesting project. It's the National Geographic's Pristine Seas Expedition, and the purpose of the expedition is to explore, document, and relate to the public facts about some of the last truly wild, pristine places left on this planet, with the hope that by doing so that we'll be able to convince policymakers and the public to protect these areas. In his travels, Enrique confronts sharks and other predators, some of which actually do dwell under the water, and he's going to talk to you about that tonight. So I'm going to turn the stage over to first Zoltan and then Enrique.
Good evening. Well, let's get out of here and let's go to Congo. And here we are in the Congo Basin rainforest. And what you see is the bottom of the forest. And you also see in this picture one of the largest viper on record. Can you find the snake? One of the largest snake on record is on this picture. It's pretty hard to find. It's right here. It's a gabon viper, and you see the head of the snake. These are the eyes. And I haven't touched the snake. I just went above it and took a picture looking downward. And here you see the head of the snake. These are the eyes, and the body coils underneath the leaf litter. It's a huge snake. It's actually really big. This is how big it is. It's one of the largest viper in the world, injects the most amount of venom of any animal on planet Earth, a full tablespoonful, and has quite long fangs, up to 2 inches long, 5 centimeters. It's really a deadly snake, and you have to be very careful. So this was in Congo. And this is one of the reasons why you have to be careful. This, you know, we move around the world a little bit, and this picture was taken in Nepal just the end of last year. This person has bitten by a venomous snake, a cobra in this case, and is completely paralyzed. He cannot breathe. The toxin blocks the communication between the nerve and the muscle. There is no antivenom in the hospital, and there is no artificial ventilator. So in order to keep this patient alive, what's happening, a family member has to push air into his lungs for every single breath for days or sometimes up to a week, hoping that the cobra venom will be broken down by the body's immune system. So globally, 100,000 people die from snake bites per year. That's 6 times more than people dying from landmines. So the question comes, so why I'm chasing all of these venomous creatures all around the planet? And here is the answer. This person, he just has faced a heart attack the night before. This is at the University of Chicago Hospital, just a couple of blocks away from Barack Obama's home. And his life has been saved by this snake, because the venom of this snake is the source of this drug, one of the major drugs used for heart attack. In fact, for the treatment of the most serious types of heart attack, you have 3 drugs of choice. 2 of them are snake venom derived. And this one, this is the pygmy rattlesnake coming from Florida. So next time you go to Florida and you go to the nature, just to be aware that, you know, one of the biggest gifts from medicine coming from right there. Let's take a look inside of the heart of this patient. So this is the heart of the same patient, what you've seen in the slide before. And this is before and this is after using the snake venom-derived drug. Here you see the coronary artery, the blood vessel, which is supplying blood to the heart tissues, and it's clogged. There's a blood clot there, so you don't have circulation. Then you apply, the cardiologist is applying the stent and the snake venom-derived drug. You remove the blood clot, and you restore the circulation, and you save the patient's life. It's really an amazing drug. And this is only one example. There are approximately 15 major medications are derived from animal venoms for, you can see, for diabetes, heart attack, as we discussed, hypertension, stroke, cancer, and HIV pain. it's really a huge and very important source for medications. Actually, one of the best-selling drug in the history of medicine is coming from a viper venom in Brazil. Yet 20 million toxins in nature remain unexplored. Those 15 drugs coming from 1,000 toxins, what has been studied by science in detail, there are 20 million toxins in nature, deep in the seas, like in the jellyfish or the corn snail in the Pacific Ocean. They all have venoms, and the venom is composed of up to 200 different types of toxins. Or if you go to the desert, you have scorpions, you have the desert vipers here in Namibia. Or you can go to the rainforest, this is back to Congo, a water cobra, or the other side of the Congo basin next to the Uganda border, the rhinoceros viper. So what's common among all of these species is that they have venom. And the venom evolved for hundreds of millions of years to immobilize and kill prey and predator in a few seconds. So they actually, one of the best molecules anywhere you find in nature that target very important parts of the human body. What you see here is actually with yellow, you see a snake toxin, and with gray, you see a molecule which is responsible in the nerve-to-muscle communication, and the snake toxin binds to that molecule, and this is actually shows how the venom or the toxins in the venom work. The toxin matches that molecule like you would put a key into the lock. And this, what is important here, that the same exact molecule has to be modified in case you want to treat a disease. So that's why toxins are such a good drug template. Terry was mentioning, at the University of Chicago, along with my colleagues, we invented a technology where you can screen up to a million different toxin variants. And just very briefly, I show you the technology. We collect toxins from different creatures, and then we create, these are the schematic drawing, the toxins, and we create combinatorial toxin libraries. We mix them in all kinds of different combination, and then we get a target. A target is something what you want to modify in order to treat a disease, and we put this library in contact with that target, and we can isolate the best candidate, which is specific for that particular target, so you don't have side effects. In order to do this one, of course, there is no other way that you have to go to nature and collect those toxins. So whenever we travel, we get the map, and we look for two factors. Where you find the snakes, or we travel to the places where you find the largest number of snakes. Of course, probably you want to avoid those areas. And the time, you know, when we're going there is the peak time for snake bites, and probably you also want to avoid those times. The snake bite, the peak of the snake bite is coincides with the rain and the elevation in the temperature, so that's the best time for catching snakes. We use all kinds of transportation means. Here we are landing. The crab is waiting for us at the airport. We go deep into the jungle. This is in Borneo. My guide just shot that monitor lizard. You know, that's not my not my catch. Or you know, sometimes we drive by four-wheel drives, or at least try to drive by four-wheel drives. Here we get stuck in the sand in Yemen. You can ask directions from the camel. You know, which way to go. Or you can show pictures of the particular snakes you are looking for the local people. This is in Yemen still. This is my bodyguard, Ahmed. And as you can see, there are plenty of AK-47s around. And of course, in Yemen, you have lots of military checkpoints. And every time we cross the checkpoint, you know, I get the questions, are you American? No. Australian? No. British? No. And once they run out of the countries, I said, well, I'm a Hungarian. And nobody knew where is Hungary, but I told them that, you know, why don't you pop over your Nokia phone? And actually, the Nokia phone is... The Nokia battery, at least, is made in Hungary. So I showed the passport and the phone, you know. And of course, every person is in love with their mobile phone. There is not a single person who wouldn't like his mobile phone. So I never, ever had any problem with military checkpoints in Yemen. I mean, this is a local hotel, and just in case, the AK-47 is right here. But anyway, this is our actual, this is my major hotel, you know, once we go for destination. This is, again, back to the Congo Basin. So I pitch up my hammock wherever I can, you know, wherever I find, you know, trees in a good distance from each other, and that's how I sleep. This is the kitchen, and then we just stay here for like 2-3 weeks. Other instances, we just can put up the mosquito net underneath the aircraft wing, or if there is no place to hang up your hammock, then you just climb up to the roof of your car. This was last week in Qatar. Next to the Saudi border, we were looking for vipers there. I love to interact with local people, and they can teach you so many interesting aspects of the local land, you know, where you can find snakes, where you can get water in the rainforest, what to do, you know, if the elephants are coming. Here in this particular picture, I'm actually trading my Banana Republic T-shirt for some of the ornaments of the kits. I love to give ride for hitchhikers. You know, I used to hitchhike while I was a student a lot. And here you see one of my hitchhikers who I gave a lift. And on the left side, she's all smiley. On the right side, you know, her expression is a little bit different. The difference between the two pictures, that on the right side, I informed her that you have 12 vipers in the basket next to you. But we did deliver her home safely, so no problem. Again, here, this is in a Darien Gap in Panama. This guy invited me to his living room and didn't mind that I'm actually taking a jumping viper along with me. But they have stories. You know, of course, I don't speak some of these languages, but it's with showing them pictures and they see what you want to do. It's really a great experience. And, you know, having a good relationship with local people is actually one of the safest things you can do when traveling. These ladies in Namibia, at the Namibia-Angola border, I was asking them, you know, about the spitting cobras, you know, in the area, but they were more excited to fix my shoes here. Or this is in Solomon Islands, and he was my local guide, you know, looking for sea snakes. But, you know, at one night we were passing this small island, and he said, "Zoltan, come here," and I show the remains of my ancestors. So we have all of this great experience, you know, while you're traveling. But this is actually the reason why I'm traveling. I'm catching a sea snake in Fiji, and actually I'm holding 200 toxins in my hand, because that venom, that sea snake, it's a highly toxic snake, contains approximately 200 different types of toxins. So this is why we're traveling. Of course, I had to ask the snake to, you know, please pose with me, because I had to give credit to the funding source, you know, for enabling me to catch the snake. And this is how I started back in Hungary. That's not a venomous snake, but I was very, very happy with that. Going back to some of the risk. So, of course, snake bites, I'm going to get there in a short while. But one of the biggest problems in Africa are the elephants, for example. This is in the Lobeka National Park. I was standing in a termite hill, and this elephant came and looked face to face to me, like from a couple of meters. I was thinking, this is the end of my life. And then my local guide, who used to be a poacher, but no, he reborn, and he's officer for the local national park, he said something to this elephant in a local language, so the elephant turned away, and now I had the courage to take a picture of his behind. This is in the southern part of the Philippines. I love to go to military camps and just rent a soldier for a week or two. There are too many problems there with pirates and also the Muslim and Christian conflicts. I'm a Hungarian, a Christian country, but my name is Zoltan, which is quite similar to Sultan. So depending which areas I've been, I was a Hungarian or a Sultan. Or this was like 20 years ago. This is in Laos. We get into a civil war. The local police told us that we cannot proceed toward Vientiane. We crossed over from Vietnam, and the Hungarian embassy sent this helicopter for a lift. But really, you know, what's really a major risk is, of course, snake bites. And I'm particularly affected by this because I'm allergic to the snake venom. and I'm allergic to the snake antivenom. So if I get bitten, I have to worry about each three factors, the allergy to the snake venom and antivenom, and the toxic effect of the venom itself. Alone, all of these three can kill a person. Three friends of mine passed away from snake bites, so it's you really have to watch what you're doing. I had six snake bites. This is the last one in the Brazilian Amazon. We had to rush back to Manaus, I know, from the Rio Negro. So what I'm getting, I'm collecting venom, but I don't collect the venom from the fang of the snake. I collect it in forms of tissues. And so I'm getting the tissues, I'm getting the tissue directly from the heart of the snake. It doesn't cause any lasting damage. You get out the tissues, and then from the cells, what you do, you can isolate the DNA. And that DNA contains all of the information you need back in the lab to recreate those toxins, to recreate those toxins which have evolved for millions of years. So this is what we're actually bringing back. And you can put this information on a USB drive, but this is the really the gold aim for us. Sometimes I bring back live snakes, and if I tell the taxi cab driver what I have in the box, those are my fastest rides from JFK to the city. And I'm very happy to show you that actually that technology has some major results. This is a new molecule coming from three different scorpion species. I mentioned that we're doing combinatorial libraries. So three different scorpion species from North Africa, Middle East, and Central America, which has promising effect for a number of different autoimmune disorders. In autoimmune disorder, the body sends a false alarm to your immune system, which causes tissue damage. And this particular toxin blocks the cell, so you don't have a tissue damage. And finally, in the last two slides, I just show you that in some sense, actually we racing with time. This picture was taken actually with Kenny. And in Vietnam, every year, 250,000 sea snakes are removed from the Gulf of Thailand and shipped to China to be eaten up alive. We don't know the venoms of these snakes. We don't know what we are eating away. So it's really an unfortunate situation. And to close my talk, I personally like two aspects of life, the beauty and the unknown. You know, whatever I do in science and in traveling, I appreciate the beauty and the unknown. And here, it just shows in this graph some of the beautiful and unknown aspects of our biosphere. We have one biosphere, we have a number of ecosystem species, tissues, largest number of different kinds we have in molecules. Those molecules gave us some major medications. But if we erase some of the species, because those are the source for those medications, then we erase the potential to make new medications. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good evening. Why would you study snakes if you're allergic to the venom and the anti-venom? Anyway, I'm an ocean explorer. I'm going to tell you about ocean exploration and the risk of ocean exploration. But first, I'd like to define what's risk. And risk is the potential that an action will lead to a loss. And risk can be measured as a probability. For example, what's the probability that you will die studying snakes with Zoltan, or that you will die on a plane crash, right? So I'm just going to show you a short video of what we do on our expeditions, ocean expeditions. This is from the Pitcairn Islands, a UK territory in the South Pacific. So we go to these places that are very remote. It takes 5 days from here, from New York, to get to the Pitcairn Islands. We are 2 days away from the closest hospital. The places are gorgeous, but we spend 4 hours underwater every day. And this is not our environment. We have to bring diving tanks, and we can have the compression accident. And also, there are lots of fish and lots of sharks. And sometimes these sharks have never seen humans before, because we go to these very remote and unexplored places. And the sharks, sometimes they get a little excited, because they come to check us out, you know, what's what's this animal with one big eye and two fins making all these bubbles and noise? And sometimes they get so excited that they bump onto the cameras. Sometimes they scratch the dome of the cameras. And the question I always get is, wow, are you afraid of sharks? This is so risky, you could be eaten by a shark. But the best question ever was a little boy in Seattle. I gave a talk earlier this year in Seattle, and this little boy asked, hey, sir, have you ever been killed by a shark? And I said, well, a few times, and really, there is no problem with the sharks. So what's the risk, what's the probability in your lifetime, if you get in the water for swimming or diving, of being killed by a shark? Well, the probability of being attacked is 0.02%. The probability of being attacked and killed is 10,000 times lower. Around the world, Zoltan said that 100,000 people die because of snake bites. 100,000. How many people do you think die every year around the world because of shark attacks? How many? 100? 10? 5. Only 5 people. A few more are attacked, but only 5 people die every year. But of course, there are other things that we do during our expeditions that are also risky. For example, taking the cab, the fast ride that Zoltan was talking about, taking the cab from home to the airport to catch the plane to go to the expedition place, which is very low, 0.52%, less than 1% probability that you will have a serious car accident in your life. Dying on an airplane crash or dying because of your ship is sinking, it's still lower. And we already know that a fatal shark attack is very, very rare. All these, the three at the bottom are statistically indifferent from zero. So when we put everything together, the probability of dying on an expedition climbs up from less than 0.1% to 0.5%. And again, the riskiest part of this is the taxi drive. Now, what is the risk of not going on an expedition? There are these institutions that are collecting data on the probability of dying under the most diverse circumstances. For example, staying at home and trying to get the bread out of the toaster with a metal knife to make a sandwich so you can sit in the couch and watch a shark documentary on National Geographic. Well, the probability of this is more than 4 times greater than going on one of our expeditions. 2.3% is the probability in your lifetime of accidental injury at home. And this is by a reputed US actuarial organization. So it doesn't make sense not to go to these places if we really worry about our well-being, right? But this is from the human perspective. Now, we really are not at risk of being attacked and killed by a shark when we are out there. But now, what's the risk for the shark? What's the risk of being a shark? What's the lifetime risk or the probability that a shark will be killed by a human? It's between 6.5% and 8%, let's say 7%, which is 3 times larger than the probability of dying between the taxi drive and the shark killing. Every year, we kill an average of 100 million sharks worldwide, mostly to feed the Asian market for shark fin soup. So it is much safer to be an explorer to dive with sharks than to be a shark and having to deal with humans. And this, despite these numbers are kind of shocking, we still have a risk going to these expeditions. And so the question is, why do we explore, right? And Terry already summarized very eloquently about the obsession and the madness and all these things. But you know, why do we explore? In my case, it was because when I was a kid, I was completely fascinated by Jacques Cousteau's underwater documentaries. For me, he was my baseline. What he showed us on TV was what was natural in the ocean for me. So now for 1 second, think about your first memory of the ocean. For how many of you that was a memorable, a pleasurable memory from your childhood? For how many of you? Raise your hands. You know, more than half of you. So this baseline is very important because this is what's natural for you. The first time you saw the ocean or you put your fingers in the water, this is your baseline. And everything that happens in your life after that, you will compare against that baseline. That's your benchmark for change. So when I was a kid, I wanted to emulate my hero. Here, same posture. But you know, I watched the documentaries, and he was showing us all these amazing images of coral reefs and sharks and large fish, whales, sea lions. But when I went swimming, this is what I saw on the Mediterranean coast of Spain. And people are also confused about where I'm from, and I'm from Brazil or Italy or Portugal, and they mix up my name all the time. And when I was diving in the Mediterranean coast of Spain when I was a kid, this is what I saw: barren rock with sea urchins, no algae, no large fish, no groupers, no sharks. And over the years, as I became a marine biologist, I understood that this was not natural, that my personal baseline was not natural, because we had degraded the ocean long before we started collecting data on the ocean, and of course before I started diving. And after 10 years in academia, studying the impact that we do to the ocean, I got so frustrated and depressed because I was seeing the places that I love so much being degraded more and more. And I conducted an expedition to a very remote place in the Central Pacific, on the Line Islands, because I wanted to know what the ocean was like 1,000 years ago. I wanted to help bring the ocean back, but bring the ocean back to what? We don't have photographs or scientific studies from 1,000 years ago. So we chose to go to a place that is very remote, uninhabited, and unfished, hoping that this would be like a travel back in time, that we could see a coral reef as it was before humans. And the expedition went very well, and Terry made me an offer that I couldn't refuse. So I risked by quitting my job in academia to join National Geographic. And that was a risk well taken, because in the last 4 years, we have been conducting expeditions to the most pristine places in the ocean, like the Line Islands in the South Pacific, an inhabited islands where we can see coral reefs in its most majestic state, untouched, unfished, where corals dominate the bottom. There are so many fish of so many species, and the place is dominated by sharks. Sharks everywhere. And to me, this is the perfect picture of a coral reef. The bottom is covered by a jungle of coral, and the water is dominated by predators. And we have learned so much because of exploring these places. We have been able to change completely, to reverse the perception of what's natural in the ocean for us. So what we learned in school was that the ecosystems of the planet were structured in what we call a biomass pyramid. Imagine the African plains, the Serengeti, hundreds of thousands of wildebeest and zebra, and just a few hundred lions. This is what we thought was also natural in the ocean. Large biomass of fish that eat plants, smaller biomass of carnivores, and a smaller biomass of sharks, of top predators. By exploring these places, we learned that a pristine reef is upside down. That if you put all the fish together and weigh them, top predators like sharks account for most of the biomass. That would be like more than one lion per every wildebeest in Africa. It was so surprising, but this is the way pristine reefs are like. Predators dominate. We also learned that other species that seem insignificant, like these giant clams with beautiful colors, we learned about their important role in the ecosystem for human health, because they filter the water, they clean the bacteria out of the water, including bacteria that cause cholera. So in reefs that are inhabited, where the locals have removed the giant clams for food or ornamental purposes, there is no natural filter. So the abundance of bacteria is 10 times the abundance of bacteria in a pristine coral reef, and there is cholera. So these animals, these giant clams, provide a service that is essential to human health. The risk of inaction is also important. If we don't go to these places to explore them, to understand them, and to help protect them, this is what we risk. Dead coral skeletons covered by slime and seaweed that produce no fish, where the water is full of microbes that cause diseases to humans, and also where the ecosystem services that these reefs provide are gone. These reefs that are not growing cannot protect the coasts anymore from storms. And I don't need to tell you what happened to the communities here in New York and New Jersey, the communities where the natural defenses like the sand dunes and the marshes were lost. So we need these services. The risk of inaction is destroying the ability of the ocean to protect all these services and goods that are so essential for our well-being. And as Terry said, we are going beyond exploration. We want to raise awareness, but also we have been working with partners around the world to inspire country leaders to protect these places. In the last few years, we've been to 7 places. 4 of them are already protected in more than 400,000 square kilometers of marine reserves. And in the next few years, we plan to go to at least 15 of these pristine places left to explore them and convince the leaders of these places to protect them. And we will be working with partners, conservation groups, business, academics in the different places, and partners like the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, whose executive director, Justin Winters, is with us tonight. And by the way, last night, they were able to raise at Christie's on the largest environmental auction ever, $35 million that will go to creation of protected areas. That's Justin. That will be dedicated to protection of creation of protected areas to save the last wild places in the ocean. And just another reminder for scale. The ocean may seem really large and inexhaustible, but if the planet was the size of a basketball, all the water in the ocean would fit in a ping pong ball. It's just, if the planet was an apple, the ocean would be thinner than the skin of the apple. So we are dealing with a very precious resource, and we cannot afford the risk of not going out there, exploring it, and try to save as much as we can. Thank you so much.
Hello, I'm Chris Johns, Editor-in-Chief of National Geographic Magazine. Thank you. I'm here to introduce the next segment of our program. I'd like to thank you all for coming this evening, and I would especially like to thank our sponsor, RBC. I think you can see tonight why I've loved working at National Geographic for more than 30 years. I want to thank Zoltan, and I want to thank Terry, and I want to thank Enrique for the inspiration that they give all of us at National Geographic every day as we rub shoulders with incredibly talented people like them and incredibly passionate people like them. Tonight, Ann Curry will lead a conversation with two of our incredibly talented and courageous photographers, Lindsay Addario and James Noctley. And James is featured in this month's National Geographic magazine in a year-long series we're doing on risk takers. So please take a look at this month's National Geographic, and you'll see an array of stories that are dedicated, as Terry spoke to us earlier, to exploration as we cover exploration, and that being an integral part of our DNA at National Geographic. Ann Curry and I share the same home state, Oregon. In fact, Ann grew up in Ashland, Oregon, which is widely known to be one of the most beautiful small towns in Oregon, or in the United States for that matter. I grew up 17 miles north of Ann in Central Point, Oregon, which is widely known as not being one of the most beautiful small towns in Oregon. Southern Oregon University is in Ashland, and we have a long history of lumberjacks and other assorted people who have made life very colorful for me. Ann is an international correspondent and a news anchor for NBC, and she's known for her humanitarian reporting, which in itself carries a good deal of risk. She recently was in Turkey interviewing Syrian refugees and trying to get to the bottom of the possible chemical attacks in Syria. And for Rock Center, Ann was just in Ecuador with the Warani people, and you can see her photographs of the Amazon basin at Google Plus. I just looked at them, and I would please ask all of you to take a look at them, too. They're powerful, wonderful pictures that address the conflict of our need for energy and how that impacts an ecosystem and how it impacts a people. And, of course, that's been one of Ann's great, great passions, and I thank you for that, Ann. So, please. Please join me in welcoming Ann Curry. Ann, thanks so much for being here.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. I am actually getting to introduce two of my favorite photographers because they risk to tell the story of our human family at risk. And so let me invite them up. They are James Notway and Lindsay Addario. Lindsay Addario is an American photojournalist. She's based in London. She photographs conflict and humanitarian issues for National Geographic and for the New York Times and also for Time magazine. She's documented oppression under the Taliban. She has covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, the Congo, and in Libya, where she was captured and held prisoner by government soldiers for 6 days. Her work for National Geographic includes Baghdad after the storm and Veiled Rebellion, about the brutalization of women in Afghanistan and also their effort to overcome it. Lindsay's numerous awards include a MacArthur Genius Grant and the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting, and we're very pleased, Lindsay, to have you here tonight.
Thank you.
Jim Notway has documented wars, conflicts, and social issues all over our world for more than 30 years. His most recent works for National Geographic were South Africa, Mandela's Children, and Indonesia, Facing Down the Fanatics. Though he has been a contract photographer for Time since 1984, he actually has self-financed trips to cover stories, including the horrific conditions under inside Romania's orphanages, and also the famine in Somalia. Jim has documented conflict in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Lebanon, Iraq, the West Bank and Gaza, Bosnia, Rwanda, Chechnya, Afghanistan, and many other countries. He has documented atrocities and social issues including war, AIDS, famine, drug addiction, prison conditions, and also the events of 9/11. Jim's many awards include the Dresden International Peace Prize last year, the TED Prize in 2007, lifetime achievement honors from both the Overseas Press Club and Time magazine, and get this, he's won the Robert Capa Gold Medal 5 times. Some of you might also know that he is the subject of the 2001 Academy Award-nominated documentary, which is called War Photographer. Jim, it is such a pleasure to be with you here tonight.
Thank you.
So this is a fantastic opportunity for us to hear from two of the greatest photographers of our time, conflict photographers of our time. And let me begin, and I think this might help set the stage. Jim, you wrote something for your workbook, Inferno. That might be a good beginning. Quoting you, "I had no intention of making a book when I set out for Romania in 1990. Consciously, I was still trying to create the few best pictures, but something happened to me inside the orphanages. The conditions in which children and old people were being kept was ghastly. The victims were staring me in the face. The reality was overwhelming, and it shook my faith. Every moment I was there, I wanted to flee." Jim, why didn't you flee? Why do you continue to go back and photograph these stories?
Well, I think it's something that all of us learn very quickly, is that the stories we cover are much bigger than we are. And it's really not about protecting ourselves, but about opening ourselves. Opening ourselves to sometimes dangerous and difficult situations, but also opening ourselves to very strong emotional reactions. And even though the temptation is to turn away and because you can't take it anymore, it actually, our duty and our discipline require us to face it and try and interpret it in a way that channels some of the emotion that we're feeling to millions of readers, so that it becomes a call to action and an essential process, element in the process of change.
Which explains why you don't call yourself a war photographer, you call yourself an anti-war photographer. Lindsay, when you hear Jim talk about this, he's talking about risk, the risk of his emotions, essentially.
Sure.
Opening up, which is painful, to see something more fully so you can capture it with your, so that others can feel it as well. What do you want to add to that? Because your work has taken you to the hell of risk in this regard.
Sure. I think one of the questions I get very often is, how do you cope with it? And how do you remain happy or sane? And for me, I think that it's really about perspective, and it's about understanding how lucky we are, because Jim and I go into these situations and we document, but we leave and we go home at the end of the day. And most of these people are there for their entire lives, and they suffer really great injustices, and they suffer violence and abuse, and they can't get out of it. So we are basically messengers. We help bring their message.
Which risk is greater? The physical risk of being in a war zone, and you have been shot at, you've been in places where you've actually been wounded. Is the physical risk greater, or is the emotional risk greater, Jim?
Well, it's hard to compare them because they both have such a different effect. But I think that you can actually avoid a physical risk if you're lucky, and I think that has something to do with it. The emotional toll is unavoidable, so it's something that you have to carry with you. Nothing is forgotten. We carry everything with us. We can only hope that we carry it gracefully and carry on.
I'm going to quote you on another issue, Lindsay, because I think it really says a lot about you as a photographer. You say, "If a woman wants to be a war photographer, she should. It's important. Women offer a different perspective. We have access to women on a different level than men have. I have always found it a great advantage being a woman." So what is the advantage to the stories you tell, and who actually gets to be a part of those stories?
Sure. I just want to put that quote in context a little bit. When I was kidnapped in Libya in March of 2011, several readers wrote into the New York Times and said, "Well, what was a woman doing there anyway?" And to me, I took very great offense, because I can do whatever I want. And I think that that was how my parents raised me, with that sort of opportunity and that optimism. And I think it's very important that women continue going to war zones. I work primarily in the Muslim world, where the society is very segregated, and I do have an access to women and to 50% of the population that is unique from my male colleagues. Often, in very conservative countries, male colleagues can't just openly go into a household and spend time with families because it's culturally not acceptable. And so I do think it's very important for women to be there. So I said that quote, and I meant it in respect to the Muslim world, but I also meant it in a greater context.
I see. Let's talk about that experience that you had. You were with a team from the New York Times. You were in Libya. You, your driver, your guide, mistakenly took you to a checkpoint where there were Gaddafi military people, and as a result, you were kidnapped and held for 6 days. What do you want to say about that experience?
I think we were covering the front line. We were covering the fighting for almost 2 weeks, and so Tyler Hicks and I had been mostly at the front for about 2 weeks, and our other two colleagues had joined us that day. And the fighting was shifting, and we made a decision to stay very close to the fighting. And we knew the risks, and the risks involved with fighting are always either you get hit by some sort of artillery or sniper fire or some sort of incoming round, or you get kidnapped. In the case of the war in Libya, the uprising in Libya, Gaddafi was very clear that he did not want journalists with the rebel movement, and he made several announcements that all Western journalists were spies and they should be killed. And we knew that in remaining very close to the fighting and in being with rebel fighters, that was one of the risks. And we decided to stay and cover the fighting because we felt it was very important that the rest of the world saw what was happening. And at some point when we decided to pull out, there was only one road out of the city. And at that point, Gaddafi's troops had already set up. And I think, you know, for me, it was one of those moments where I was laid on the ground and I had a gun to my head, as did all of my colleagues. We each had a soldier with us putting a gun to our heads. And they were deciding whether to execute us. And it was that moment where you said, okay, this is the end. And this was my decision. I can't, you know, I could never turn around and blame that on anyone else because I made a choice to be there. And that's part of our job.
Part of our job.
It is part of our job.
You still do this job.
I still do this job, of course. I have not been back into active combat. I was in Syria. I've been covering the refugee crisis. But I'm trying to focus more on the humanitarian angle and less on the combat. I've never actually felt I was a very good combat photographer because I'm usually the first one face down on the ground when the bullets start flying, unlike Jim.
Well, actually,
sort of horrible at war photography.
Well, actually, I think maybe some people would argue that your pictures would call you a liar on that point because you've done some wonderful pictures of that. Jim, you were wounded in Iraq in 2003. What do you want to talk about regarding that? Because you have, we know from imagery that we've seen, you've been under fire in multiple places, including in South Africa. But in Iraq, it was a situation in which you actually got hit.
Well, I've had many close calls. I've been in many places where people next to me have been shot. I've had a rocket land on the ground a few meters away and not explode. Numerous times, and bullets just impacting around me. And it, as Lindsay said, it just comes with the territory, and it's something we go into with our eyes open, and we accept it from the start. I've been injured 5 times. The worst time was in Iraq. I was working with a correspondent from Time magazine, Michael Weisskopf. We were doing a story on a single platoon of American soldiers in the most hostile part of Baghdad, and someone threw a grenade into the Humvee we were riding in. Normally, everyone would have died, but Mike was hardwired somehow. I mean, many things could have happened. He could have tried to save himself. He could have ducked. But he was hardwired to try and throw the grenade out and save everyone. Well, the grenade blew up and he sort of had a trap next to his leg and it blew his hand off. but I think it absorbed the impact and the destructive force of the grenade so that all of us were wounded, but no one was killed. So, you know, hats off to Michael, and he's, you know, has mine and the soldiers who were with us eternal thanks.
So you have said that the emotional risk is one that stays with you, the emotional cost, but that the physical risk, there is a kind of feeling that you might be able to mitigate that risk a little bit until, of course, you can't when somebody throws a grenade into where you are. So there's that kind of unknown as well. So I think probably most of us are listening to this. We can hear that you're compelled to tell these stories. But when we think about these kinds of risks, we wonder if it's, I think some of us in this audience might wonder if it's too much. So then there must come to some, there must be something that drives you more than anything else. Because you could take pictures of pretty flowers, but you're not, right? You just grimaced. There is something, that was a, I don't know if you saw that, but that hurt me. That was painful. That was a big grimace. There's something that is in your head and in your heart that is driving you. And you hinted at it a little bit talking about the orphanages in Romania, but you're not staying in the orphanages. You're going into these places. So talk to us a little bit about why it is worth it.
It's hard to answer that question. I think ever since I started, it's just been something that has taken over my life. It's sort of beyond my... there are issues that I read about and then I feel very strongly about and I start researching and then I decide I want to go somewhere and I start calling around and seeing if anyone will back the trip. And if they won't, I usually will save my money and go. I think that people should see what's happening around the world, especially if they don't want to see it. I think that, you know, we're at a time in our lives where the United States has been at war in two countries, and a lot of young Americans are dying, and many, many thousands of Afghan and Iraqi civilians have died. And we need to see that. That's something that's very important. I don't think that it's okay to just turn your head and not know about what's happening. So I do wish I didn't care so much. I do wish that I just could be happy photographing flowers. I'm sure my parents would be very happy if I was photographing flowers. But I think that it's something that I can't necessarily, I wouldn't be happy, I wouldn't feel fulfilled if I wasn't doing this.
How do you answer that question, Jim?
Once you set foot in a war zone, you're at risk. And you can do everything right and still get taken out. There's absolutely no assurances of anything. But there's never more at stake for a nation than there is during a time of war. And a mass audience needs to have understanding on a day-to-day basis so that perspectives are created, a narrative emerges through which people can make judgments and have opinions about what's going on. So that whether it's your nation at war or a foreign nation, public opinion and international pressure can be brought to bear on the process of change.
Is there...
Risk just comes with the territory. And I think it was Terry who was reading the ad for explorers, that it is, once you've committed yourself to this and you see that it has an effect, you're on the hook. You, after a while, you know how to do it. You have experience. You know how to navigate these situations. You can handle it. You can get your pictures published. So you do become a voice for people who otherwise would not have a voice. And it's very hard to walk away from that responsibility.
Do you see it as a responsibility?
Yeah, I agree entirely with what he said.
So, and the thing about it is that this work, which is about meaning, it sounds to me like listening to you about a sense of wanting justice for people who don't have any. It's almost as if I'm also hearing you talk about valuing people who are ignored and not heard in our world. It is, for both of you, an unlikely profession. Both of you came from Dartmouth. You were studying international relations and history, and you say you're not a trained, classically trained photographer. And yet, how did you get into to this work?
Well, I was at Dartmouth during the Vietnam War and the American Civil Rights Movement. Both major events in our contemporary history were happening simultaneously. And the power of press images on both of those events was very strong on me, on our nation, and on me personally. I think our military and political leaders were telling us one thing and photographers were telling us another. So when I decided to become a photographer, that's what I wanted to do. And I basically trained myself. I became a photographer in order to be a war photographer, and it took me 10 years of training and work before I felt I was capable of making a genuine contribution. And then once I started, I never looked back. Mm-hmm.
And you actually are not a classically trained photographer either.
No, but I also think being a photographer is very little, it has very little to do with being trained. I think a lot of it comes from instinct, it comes from curiosity, comes from passion, dedication, getting yourself there, getting access, making people feel comfortable, making people forget that you're sitting there. Being able to be versatile. There are so many qualities about being a photographer that don't have to do with the camera. For me, the camera was just a tool. It was just sort of figuring out how to use this thing so I could convey the message that people were telling me. So it never was about learning how to be a photographer. It was about learning how to tell a story and figuring out how to use a Nikon, what I use. And so, yeah.
With the risk that you just described and the effort with all of these talents and attributes to sort of get the picture, have you had the experience of editors saying, you know what, actually that's too much, I'm not sure we can publish that. It's really just too much. You don't have to be that honest, but you're looking at me very quizzically. Yes. Has it ever happened to you in your career that they've said?
I just wanted you to ask you to say it again.
Well, I wanted to ask you about whether an editor has ever said, that picture is too much, I'm not going to publish it. And you risked for that photograph. Have you ever had one turned down?
I suppose that's happened. I happen to work with editors who I have a lot of respect for. And they have decisions to make that are beyond the scope of decisions I have to make. So everyone I work with on a close basis wants my input, they want my opinion, and they have a lot of respect for my opinion, but sometimes they have to make a decision based on their role that I wouldn't make, and I just have to accept it and respect it and believe that it's for a good reason.
It's such a remarkably thoughtful answer. If I'm in that situation and I've just risked my life and I've risked my emotional health and potential traumatized myself taking a photograph, and an editor said, you know, I don't really want that photograph, I might respond slightly differently. So I
don't talk about that.
So I guess maybe...
No, but they don't say it that way.
Oh.
That's the difference.
They don't say it
that
way.
They make sense.
They make sense. So what I wonder is...
Not that you weren't making sense.
No, I was making a little bit of sense. I get it. No, but what do you say to yourself? And this may be something that's not something that you're conscious of, and so you can't answer the question. Maybe it's at this point in the game, after all these years, it's not a conscious thing. But I wonder, and when you're in the throes of it, what do you say to yourself? Do you have a mantra? Do you say it's going to be okay? How do you calm yourself and focus on the work, given all of this risk?
I'm going to answer that question, but I'm going to go back to the earlier one, too. And I'll just say that, okay, my heart gets broken when the picture I really believe in doesn't make it. And I just have to, you know, live with a broken heart and carry on, pick myself up and go.
Right.
When things are falling apart around me, my default position, which is nothing I do consciously, it just happens to be the way I'm wired, is to get very calm.
Just slow everything
down.
I
get really calm somehow when things are at their worst. And I think it's simply a survival instinct, because you have to process a lot of information that's coming at you from different directions very quickly, and you have to make decisions that can have very serious consequences, and you're the only one that can make those decisions. And they're sometimes split second, so you have to be processing this information with as much clarity as possible.
That's a very good skill to have. What is your reaction to that statement from Jim?
First, I'll answer the other question about it. I spent on and off about 2 months in the Korangal Valley. I wasn't there for the entire 2 months. I came and went. And it was in 2007, in October of 2007, and Elizabeth Rubin, who is a writer for the New York Times Magazine, and I lived in a bunker with men on the side of a mountain, and every day we were shot at and we were mortared, and we went on 6-7 hour a day patrols. And it was very intense. And at the end, the entire mission culminated with a 6-day mission where we were airlifted onto the side of a mountain, and it was a battalion-wide mission, and we spent 6 days walking through the mountains looking for the Taliban. And at the end of the mission, we were ambushed, and 3 soldiers were shot, and 1 was killed, and it was very intense. We just slept on the side of the mountain with nothing but what we had on our backs. And when I came back, I was pretty traumatized. It was the first time I had actually felt emotionally shaken to the point where I would just spontaneously break down and cry in the middle of, like, dinner, for example. And I didn't really know how to process it. And so when the story finally was about to run, one of the images that they had slated for the cover was a young boy with shrapnel wounds to his face. And I had been in the what's called the TOC in the military. It's a tactical operations center, I think. And I had been in there when the combat was going on, and we were watching on infrared screens, on drone feeds, on several different feeds of the fighting. And we witnessed the entire battle, that the Taliban had come in, they had attacked this base, and the Americans had dropped a bomb. And the next day, we flew exactly into that area. We asked to go there. We flew into that area, and families started bringing the injured civilians. And this little boy was one of the injured civilians who was brought in. And we knew the entire story, because we watched it on the command center, and we went there. And when the story went to be published, the PAO, the public affairs officer with the military, called the editor-in-chief of the magazine and said, we cannot confirm that this boy was injured in shrapnel in an American bombing. And the editor-in-chief made a decision to pull the image from the cover of the magazine. And I was in Darfur at the time, and I got a call saying that not only was the image pulled from the cover, but the editor-in-chief refused to even print it. It wouldn't go in a slideshow. It would never be printed. And for me, it was so offensive, because I had spent weeks risking my life in a very dramatic way. It was one of the hardest embeds I've ever done. And basically, it was his word over mine, and I lost. And to me, it was very offensive, because I will risk my life if you will publish, but if you won't publish, don't ask me to risk my life. And so that, for me, was very important.
So there's a risk of being disappointed as well, the sense that, you know, you've poured everything into something, and then to have it not be published, because that was what you were working for. You were working to be transformative with an image.
Sure.
That was so powerful.
I understand if an image isn't published because it doesn't tell the story, but don't pull an image because you don't believe what I say, because I was there. I think there's a very dramatic difference. There are hundreds of images that haven't been published because they didn't tell the story in the right way, or they weren't good enough, or the composition, it didn't work with the other pictures in the spread. But it was a question of my integrity as a journalist, and that was what was offensive.
Right. So in terms of the second question, which is, what do you say to yourself? How do you, I mean, we all react differently to stress. Sometimes it's nothing we can change, right?
Yeah.
So when you've had so much experience with this, what do you do to stay coherent.
I react much like Jim. I think it is a survival mechanism. I get very quiet. I go to a very sort of calm place, and I sort of resign myself to the fact that there are certain things I have control of and certain things I don't have control of. And for example, in Libya, I was very nervous because I sensed something might happen. But once we got taken, and once we were lied down on the ground and we were tied up and blindfolded and then beaten up and groped and held for 6 days, at the point when I was actually tied up, I immediately went into a place where I just said, you know, this is out of my hands. And the only thing I can do is stay alive and stay calm as much as I have control over that.
So with all of this effort and all of this risk then, because it's a lot of it, this is sort of multi-layered risk in for a goal that is clearly deep internalized for both of you, just very important for both of you. Then when you look at your work, what is it that you, when you look back, because Jim, after more than 30 years, this huge body of work, what do you want your work to have done? What do you want your work to have said to the world?
You know, I think human values have a range from very high to very low. And I think that what I've learned, I've certainly seen the worst and I've also seen the best. And sometimes you see the best in the worst situation. So I think I've learned the value of I've really learned the value of tolerance and respect and compassion and courage and forgiveness. And I think those higher values become very clear to you. And you wish that decisions were made based on our highest values. And if they were more consistently made on those values, then we'd go wrong much less.
Is there a feeling that you need proof that your pictures have changed the world, or do you just have to live with the hope that they have? When I say change the world, I mean change the way people think. You're never going to necessarily hear from them, but clearly they've made a difference. So how do you internalize that? How do you think about that?
Well, I see my work as a small part of a greater work that all the press is doing, especially on contemporary conflicts. It's not just any one person. It's the accumulation of information day in and day out that allows things to change. So.
So you're happy being part of the wave, part of this wave of this effort to hopefully cause more good to happen in the world.
I think we can see it. Change doesn't happen quickly, but, at one point, for example, there was overwhelming public approval for the war in Iraq. Fast forward a few years, and there's overwhelming disapproval for the war in Iraq among the American public. What made the difference was information. The information provided by all the reporters and photographers, day in and day out, year in and year out, the narrative changed. Because the perspective changed. Without that information, it wouldn't have changed. So I think, I see that and I have faith in that process. Sometimes your pictures can have a more immediate effect, especially in humanitarian situations. I went to the famine in Somalia in 92 with no assignment. I just went on my own. I didn't have any support. And the New York Times Magazine ended up running it as a cover story with many, double-page pictures. It was a very powerful publication. 17 years later, I met a head of delegation for the International Red Cross who wanted to thank me for the effect that article had on the ICRC's ability to mobilize the largest relief operation in their history since World War II, and he credited it with saving 1.5 million lives. Very rarely do we hear something so direct. And I would say that validated my entire career and validated my faith in the press and in the power of pictures. And I think 1.5 million lives is the power of the press.
Do you look for meaning? Have you heard about an impact of one of your images? Is this something that's important to you, or you just keep putting it out there with, as the word we just heard from Jim was faith?
I keep putting it out there. I don't. I get emails, I get feedback, but I don't necessarily know whether my work has made an impact in the overall. It's something that you never really know unless you have a situation like Jim's. I know recently I've been doing a lot of work on maternal mortality and women who die in childbirth. And I was recently contacted by a big medical company in America, and they said they used a video I did of a woman bleeding to death on camera. I was shooting video for the first time, and a woman died in front of me. And I kept saying on the video, she's bleeding, where is the doctor? Someone go get the doctor. And she died. And they used that video, they've shown that video before, and it's raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight maternal mortality. And for me, that's an example similar to Jim's. You know, I really think that maybe I can go for years and not really hear of an impact, and then I hear that and it's enough.
You both of you take images that clearly mean that you can't stand back, you know, there you are in it. So, and that's something that, you know, we've seen video, we talk about video, we've seen video of you, especially in South Africa when you're under fire and you're sort of trying to negotiate in that calm state you just described so that everyone is going to be safe, so that you're going to be safe. But I'm wondering what you think about in terms of as you use your gear and you're taking these pictures, do you assess how much does the risk of a situation affect? Because you want to get close to get, clearly from your images, you're trying to get as close as possible. So how do you assess what's worth the risk in getting that photograph? Are you blinded by the fact that you're shooting through a lens? Does that make you feel more safe than it should make you feel?
I've never felt that taking pictures makes me safe. I've heard other photographers say it, that they feel like they're in some kind of bubble when they're taking pictures. I've never felt that. I've always felt very vulnerable. And I think when you have the camera up to your eye is when you are at maximum vulnerability, because your awareness of everything around you gets focused into the frame. So I think that's when you are most vulnerable. And I've never fooled myself into thinking that's what happens to people around me can't happen to me just as well.
So it's so interesting because you're talking about having a decisive moment, as Henri Cartier-Bresson talks about. You need to have the technical, your brain needs to be aware of what's happening technically so you've got everything, because you're not probably shooting automatic on everything or the picture would not be so great. And then you also have to think about composition and all this while you're thinking about your safety at the same time, because as you're saying, you're not feeling safe, you're feeling quite aware of your vulnerability. So what do you think allows that process? Because that is a lot of processing to capture this beautiful image that you hope will affect people in a deep and transformative way.
Well, you don't want to rush things. I mean, you have a language. Photography is a language, and you have to, and you want your testimony to be eloquent and powerful. So you want to use that language to its maximum effect, which means you have to concentrate, you have to wait, you have to compose, all for the purpose of creating a message which has power. And it's a risk. You just simply put yourself at risk. I think every photographer has a personal sense of their ratio between getting their job done and how much risk they'll take. Some will take more, some less, and I think it's a personal decision that cannot be judged by anybody else.
So as we were just hearing this idea about it's a personal judgment that everyone takes, so I'm wondering, you know, it almost seems like if you're going to be out there and you're going to be vulnerable, bloody hell, this picture better be good. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, if I'm going to be out there, I got to get something that's going to be worth what I'm going. You're nodding yes. Okay.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, it's what you hope. I mean, it doesn't always happen. Every situation is different. In Libya, we were taking extraordinary risks because it was before the no-fly zone, so there were still helicopters coming in with gunships spraying the ground all around us from above. There was tank fire coming in. There were snipers often close enough. And we were on one paved road in the middle of the desert that was completely flat. There was nowhere to hide. There was nothing armored to hide behind. And none of us had flak jackets. And so it was an extremely dangerous situation. So every day we went out there and we try and take photos. But, you know, a helicopter came right above you and starts spraying the ground around you and you go like this. And you, you know, but then you think, wait, I should be photographing because actually there's a really interesting picture and all the guys, all the rebels trying to shoot up at a helicopter with a Kalashnikov, which is, you know, so you also have to remind yourself to photograph. So, you know, can you take cover effectively and still photograph? Or is there no cover and you decide you might as well just photograph anyway? I mean, these are questions that you ask yourself. What I find very often when I'm in a war zone is that there are days when I am extremely courageous and I feel very confident, and there are days when I'm terrified from the moment I wake up. I just decide, you know, I don't feel comfortable going that close. And so I don't. I listen to that. I try and stay back. Maybe I'll work in the hospital. I'll try and do the civilian aspect. And so I just try to listen to wherever I feel most comfortable. But sometimes, you know, if all my friends are jumping in a car and going, sometimes I'll jump in and I'll go and I'll end up making a really good picture. But it's very difficult to navigate that fear and that balance of needing to make pictures and having to be there and balancing the fear.
So you have talked about the responsibility you feel towards the people who you take pictures of. You feel responsibility. Let's get their story out. They're unseen, unheard. They have a right to be heard, especially for this level of suffering they're enduring. Do you feel a responsibility to the audience, to the people who are looking at the picture as well? Talk
Absolutely.
About that.
I mean, I think your responsibility is to get the story right. We see a lot of terrible things. I don't want to sensationalize terrible things. I want there to be a sense of compassion in the image I make so that the audience can have a human connection to the people I'm photographing and not turn away from it, but actually, you know, connect. So I feel that responsibility to the audience.
You want to answer that question?
No, definitely the same.
So I'm going to ask you some technical questions because it sounds like you go in with two cameras, right? I've seen a video about you. You're very regimented in how you organize yourself so that when you're in the situation, you are not going to run out of battery. You are going to be in the zone. So talk to me about the, because you're self-taught, as you say, the methodology that you use, not in every detail, but how do you make sure that when you go in, you have everything you need so that you are primed for the picture. How do you think about that?
I don't need very much. I usually take everything I need, and everything I need I have on me, which is usually very little. I usually work with one camera and one lens, and I maybe have a spare lens and a belt bag. I don't use long lenses because I want to get very close to the action. So I'm very unencumbered. I like to be agile and quick, and I'm very improvisational and spontaneous how I work.
Okay, and how about you? Do you carry more than one camera? How do you,
When I watched the documentary on Jim, War Photographer, it's really funny because there's a scene.
You really have to see it. It's so good.
You should see it. There's a scene where you're cleaning your cameras and you're preparing everything for the next day, and he's wearing a white shirt and he's very organized. And I just think of myself and I'm a complete disaster. I have stuff falling out of my pockets. I have bubblegum wrappers. I have chewing gum in my lenses. You know, I'm not at all organized. I have I have two camera bodies, and then I carry about four lenses, which is way too much. And I'm always weighed down.
down, but you know, when I am going to a front line where I have to run, I bring two bodies and usually two lenses, one a zoom. But I'm not very organized.
Do you have you use fixed lenses or you use moved?
So when I have the luxury of time, like when I'm doing a National Geographic assignment, I'll use fixed 1.4 lenses. If I'm working in Libya, for example, and there's a lot of fighting, I'll usually put a 24 to 70. And then a fixed lens on the other. So usually it depends on sort of if it's breaking news and I have to sort of be able to have a little versatility.
So even though you're saying you're a disaster with the gum wrappers, you actually are still thinking ahead, predicting what the situation might be, organizing what lenses I'm going to need, figuring out what you
extra
need to carry.
Extra batteries, car inverter, all that stuff.
But the difference is that a lot of images that we look at that are really beautiful are ones that are very premeditated. And the difference in your work is that you don't have that luxury. You are having to use your gut in that moment, see it, shoot it, see it, shoot it, see it, shoot it. And you don't know always what you have, but you probably have a pretty good idea because of your talents. Yeah. You grimace there again.
No. I'm not gonna say
no. I'm the one who doesn't know any idea.
I call that accelerated seeing. And you make images in a split second, sort of on a dead run, that look like they're very composed and you spend a lot of time, you know, contemplating things, but actually it was done in a moment. And I call it accelerated seeing. And I think it's the analogy I use is to an athlete. You know, a good hitter in baseball can see the ball coming at them in a way that most people can't. And I think it's something that comes from training. Maybe it's a natural trait, I'm not really sure, but I think it's something we're capable of.
Yeah, and anticipating what's going to happen exactly.
So now there's been a lot of talk about the future of photojournalism. And on one hand, we hear that people are saying that because magazines are changing, because the web is different, that there may be some future that in which we don't see as much photojournalism. And then there are other people who argue, and I'm among them, that the web is going to open us up in a bigger, broader way, and that people are so much more interested in pictures today than they have ever been, participating in them, but also marveling over something that's really marvelous. People are opening up. So that would be my argument. What do you think, would you say would be based on all these years you've worked in this, all the commitment, the risk that you've put into this, what would be your greatest wish for the future of photojournalism of the kind that you're doing, the kind that talks about people, people who are not heard and not seen? What would be the thing you'd like to say about that?
Well, I'm with you. I think that we have a great future and that we're in a transitional period right now and we're kind of reinventing ourselves. And things are changing, but I don't see any reason to be afraid. I think we should be bold, and we have tremendous opportunities ahead of us. So I think as things change, they'll change in a good direction.
And?
Yeah, I think the internet affords us more exposure than we've ever had. I think maybe the amount of pages in the actual print has diminished, but we really have incredible platforms to publish things, especially with multimedia and sound and stills. I mean, I think we do have a lot of latitude. I think and I don't know if this is sort of the correct answer in the context of the question, but I think that one thing that has changed, you said, what would be your one wish? I think that journalists are increasingly getting targeted in war zones, and we're being kidnapped and held for ransom and held. And I don't know, maybe in your career that happened before, but I know that in Afghanistan and Iraq, in the early days of Iraq, it wasn't necessarily one of the fears I had. And in going into Syria, it's one of the first things that I think about. And I wish that people would just leave the journalists alone to do the work, you know, because we are there to document and to provide a historical record and of both sides, of either side, of any part of the conflict that we can access. And I think it's important to just let journalists work.
I think Robert Capa said it very well when he said, the greatest wish of a war photographer is to be put out of business.
Mm. Thank you both for being here tonight. It's been incredibly illuminating to hear you and to hear your passion for the work, and also, I think, to honor your courage by giving you a voice in front of all these people tonight. Thank all of you for joining us and for being here.